You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. As the intro says, I am your host, Neff. For those of you who are new to the show, welcome. And for those of you who are joining me again on another episode, thank you for riding with me this far. I'm on episode 8 now. I'm still kind of shocked that I'm here still, but I'm also realizing that this is something that, you know, I've been looking forward to and I enjoy doing, you know, for the time being. I hope you guys really got a kick out of our last episode that I did with my very close friend Diane, Inside Out. It was a really fun episode to do, and I'm looking forward to us doing some more episodes where we talk about some movies. But in the meantime, today we're going to be talking about a book entitled Stand Your Ground, Bodies and the Justice of God. And this book is by Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas. And so before I dive into the book and talking a little bit more about, you know, who the author is, what the point of the book is, and things that stood out to me, of course, we're going to start this episode with a segment that we all know as Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. And so, yeah, so for those of you who do not know what this is just a little moment where I reflect on something that has been interesting or that's been on my mind or that just, you know, stood out to me during the week. And interesting enough, sometimes these thoughts or these musings that I have kind of come up as I'm preparing to do the podcast episode. So, you know, sometimes I think they will connect a little bit to what's going on with what I'm talking about, and other times they may not. So it kind of depends. But today I wanted to talk about this idea around demonizing Black spirituality. And I think this idea or this thought really came to me when I was reflecting on this book, because as we would talk about later, Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas does talk a lot about Black faith and Black spirituality. And I know in this book, it's going to be specifically around, like, I guess the Christian faith, and she does bring up the African faith as well. But I guess what I noticed as I was reading this book is that I was reflecting on this time where Beyonce created Black is King a while ago for Disney Plus, and after it came out, it was just interesting to see the different mixes of responses that came out of it. So on one hand, there were Black people that were like, wow, like, it was cool to see, you know, Black spirituality presented in a way that was so beautiful and diverse and blah, blah, blah. And then on the other hand, you had people, especially from the Christian faith, being like, oh, this is demonic. Why are you guys doing this? Blah, 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 blah. And for me, it was really interesting because on one hand, I was like, you know, Beyonce created this and it's on Disney Plus. Like, it wasn't on TBN. It wasn't on any other Christian broadcasting network that, you know, so if there was like a moment where we really want to critique why are Christians putting stuff on their platform that's not specifically Christian stuff, I was like, sure, you know, that's a moment to have that conversation, right? But the fact that people were up in arms that this thing was being broadcasted on Disney Plus to me was very interesting and alarming, especially considering that even though in the West, I guess there's a lot of African Americans or Black people in general that do identify with the Christian faith in some type of way, if we look around the world globally, there's not everybody that's Black or African American are Christian. Like, there's a lot of different faiths that we hold, and if you know, and there's diversity, you know, in that. And so for me, especially again considering that this thing was posted on Disney Plus, which is not a Christian platform, I felt like it was something I was like, this is appropriate that you're providing people that have another faith that's not Christian and they happen to be Black a space where they can see themselves. And it doesn't only have to be like, you know, this charismatic Black Christian African-American person. Because if we really think about it, I know for me, when I'm watching movies on like, you know, BET, Netflix, or whatever, where it's like centered around Blackness, a lot of the times, surprisingly, we always highlight the fact that Black people are Christians on those things, right? Every once in a while, maybe you might have somebody that's like a Hebrew Israelite or Muslim or something else. But even then, sometimes it's seen with like this negative connotation, you know, and I don't know if that's just something I'm reading out of it, but that's usually what I see. And so, again, this forced me to really think about the craziness of that, right? I think the hard part for me as I'm deconstructing faith and deconstructing being Black and all these different things, it's really hard and sad to be, you know, more aware of the fact that anything that Black people touch, whether it's music, faith, fashion, whatever it is, like as soon as a Black person has a hold of it, even if it's good, even if in a few months down the line, somebody white or somebody Hispanic or somebody whatever that's not Black is going to end up taking it and repurposing it to build their own brand, it's always seen as too ghetto, you know, this is demonic, this isn't okay, blah, 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 until somebody takes it and makes it their own. And that's something that I think is very challenging and very hard. Even for me, as I was growing up, I remember, you know, I went to a Christian private school with predominantly white people. And I remember for a while, like, there was a negative connotation around, you know, oh, like, you know, rap music, of course. And even like the Black church, which to me, when I was later on learning that the Black church was a product of slave owners not wanting us to be a part of their church, like they were kicking us out of their church, and Black theology and all this stuff in a way was like, was demonized, even though there wasn't anything much different except for the fact that we were looking at scripture and recognizing our humanity and recognizing that we weren't called to the harsh slavery that this country was putting us under. So really what it came down to, they were demonizing our faith because we were challenging their use of the Christian faith, right? It wasn't that our faith, there was something wrong with it. It was the fact that it was challenging their status quo, and that had to be silenced, you know? And again, I know this is, doesn't only apply to Black Christians, but again, it irks me when I keep seeing like every single thing that's tied to Blackness, especially when it comes to Black spirituality, it's automatic that it's demonic, right? And I will say that I'm not saying that there probably aren't faiths and religions and traditions and things out there that don't have demonic things to them. I'm not taking anything away from that concept, because I do think every faith out there has their things that are demonic, that are oppressive. I would even say, even if we look at their Christian faith itself, you know, the tenets and everything that are in the Bible, you know, about love, compassion, and empathy, and creating a world for people that are just, those are beautiful things. But then when we see how those things have been, you know, moved around to fit this lens of white supremacy, that's demonic. That is something that is not of God, that we're not, you know, handling. And so I did love, like, one of the people that I follow named Lovey Ajayi. She has a blog and she does a lot of other cool things. But she did write a post about the irony or the hypocrisy of, you know, Christians being so quick to weaponize their spirituality and call other things demonic so quickly, but they don't take a minute to like observe like what we're doing that's demonic. I stand. Like, I was happy to read that somebody finally said something. Somebody that's in a seat where people can actually listen was calling that out. And I think for me, that's something that I'm wanting to challenge us to think about too. And I've challenged myself to think about, like, what are we demonizing that shouldn't be demonized? Or what are we demonizing that we need to take time to sit down and really learn more about it to see, before we make our judgments, right? And I think in that too is like, you know, a challenge to not demonize something that you don't necessarily subscribe to, or not to demonize something that you don't understand, right? And so I know for me as a Christian, for example, I've had to do the work of learning, you know, demonizing other faiths that don't believe the same thing that I do, and being open to the fact that we live in a world where there's multiple religions, and whether or not, you know, I'm right, they're right, whatever the thing is, we need to figure out how can we come together and work with each other and talk with each other and love each other despite our differences. And if that means, like, as we're talking, maybe somebody becomes a Christian, cool. If I end up, you know, identifying as something else later on after talking with somebody, cool. But at the end of the day, demonizing other spiritualities or other spiritual beliefs or other religions really never gets you anywhere. If anything, it shuts the door for an opportunity to really grow and get to know other people and just experience, like, humanity for what it is, you know? And so I know I did start this talking about what it looks like when, you know, how it's been, how it feels when we're demonizing Black spirituality. But I do think, like, again, this can be extended to so many different things, because what it really comes down to, and what we will talk about a little bit through this book, is that a lot of the times I think anything that is non-white, that is not okay under the white gaze, is often demonized, right? And so that means, like, again, it's Black spirituality, Indigenous spirituality, anything that's from Africa, anything that's Latino spiritual, anything that's not white cishet men spirituality is automatically demonized and not seen as the norm. And that's something that with this podcast, I want to ask us all to just challenge a little bit. And again, it's not saying that you can't be true to your faith or proud of your faith, or that you shouldn't be, you know, wanting to tell people about it or anything like that. Because I know once we're excited about something or we're proud of something, we want to talk about it. So that's not a bad thing. But it's asking you to keep in mind the language that you use when you're talking about things that you may not know or may not understand. And also being willing to be like, hey, I just don't know this. I don't understand this. Because I do think a lot of the times the reason that we demonize other people and their backgrounds and their faith, a lot of the time it really comes down to, I don't know anything about you. I don't understand this. This is different from me. So instead of me sitting with myself and admitting that I need to learn, I need to find a Google, or I need to go get a book on the subject, and I need to take the time to educate myself on what's going on or what I don't understand, instead I take the coward's way out and I, you know, demonize the person. I undermine everything that they stand for. I make them feel inferior so I can feel superior to them, right? And I think, unfortunately, that is an American thing to do. I think it's a human thing to do. But for the sake of this podcast and what we're deconstructing from this Western side, it's a very American thing to do, to say, I don't understand your food. I don't understand your spirituality. I don't understand your culture. And instead of taking some time to learn and to grow and challenge myself to see things differently, I'm going to make you feel small so I can feel better about myself and my inability to learn, or my inability to humble myself and, you know, really do the work of exploring what's out here, right? And so today, this is something that I just want to challenge everybody to do. If there's ever a moment that something presents itself to you that you do not understand, that you find yourself inclined to just, you know, quickly dismiss it as like, this is evil or this isn't good or blah, 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 blah. And because it's, especially if it's different from what you're used to, take a breath and just take some time to learn more about the thing before you jump to a conclusion. And if you end up really finding out that that thing is evil or that thing is harmful or whatever the case may be, fine. Like, you can own that you don't like that thing and you find it evil, and that's fine with me. But again, I want us to challenge this quick notion of I need to quickly say something is not good because I don't want to deal with the implications of that. You know what I mean? And again, just thinking back to what I said about Black spirituality, the fact that a lot of Black spirituality does challenge the white status quo, I'm not shocked that seeing Black people free and celebrating themselves and loving God and the way that they see free, I'm not surprised that the powers that be see that and they're threatened by it, because Black freedom is not something that can coincide with white supremacy. So it makes sense that instead of them sitting with Black freedom and Black spirituality and seeing the beauty of that, that there's this desire to suppress it and demonize it, you know? And again, I know I'm speaking from this Black Christian worldview, but I will venture to say that as I'm deconstructing and I'm seeing all these different Black traditions and faiths come up, especially on TikTok, everybody's deconstructing on TikTok. So as I'm watching all these different things come up and seeing the freedom that comes with Black people being able to be like, I can own my faith, I can own my spirituality, I'm empowered by that. And I will venture to say that if that means that you have to step away from the Christian faith to experience freedom, as much as I want people to be Christians and I think Christianity is cool and I'm jazzed by it, I would rather you not experience oppression and self-hate and all this other stuff and not be a Christian than you come to the Christian side and you're back to experiencing self-hate and all this other stuff, right? And so with that said, let's dive into this book, Stand Your Ground. So obviously, before I begin this book, I do want to acknowledge that there will be some obvious bias from my end towards this book, which is basically prejudice in favor for this, you know, author and the book topic and all that stuff, because of the way that it has changed me, the things that I've learned. And I will say that I have a particular bias towards just listening to Black women who are in this theological space, no matter their gender identity or sexuality. I just have learned a lot from them, considering the fact that, you know, obviously they are like me, but also in this totem pole of life, Black women tend to be towards the bottom a lot of the time. So the people often that are most oppressed usually bring something to the table, in my opinion, when it comes to talking about different topics, because they really have to wrestle, especially with when it comes to being in the Christian faith. I feel like there's a lot of wrestling that we have to do to kind of stay there, right? So, and again, that's my opinion and my bias. So I just want to, you know, put that on the table and acknowledge it before I move forward in talking about this book. And so as I normally do with this podcast, I will start by just introducing the book and the author. So from the publisher's standpoint, I'm going to read just a little bit about what they say about what the book is about. And then again, I will go into Dr. Brown Douglas's background so that you can hear a little bit about who she is and what she's about. And again, these are just like small blurbs. So, you know, just don't expect that you'll get everything from that. But, you know, I'm encouraging you all to hear both of these blurbs and eventually do your own research if you want to learn more. So from the about the book, we have: on the Sunday morning after the acquittal of Trayvon Martin's killer, Black preachers around America addressed the questions his death raised for their communities. Where is the justice of God? What are we to hope for? In this timely and compelling book, Kelly Brown Douglas examines the myths and narratives underlining a Stand Your Ground culture, taking seriously the social as well as the theological questions raised by this and similar events from Ferguson, Missouri to Staten Island, New York. But the author also brings another significant interpretive lens to this text, that of a mother. She writes, "There has been no story in the news that has troubled me more than that of Trayvon Martin's slaying. President Obama said that if he had a son, his son would look like Trayvon. I do have a son, and he does look like Trayvon. In the face of tragedy and indifference, Kelly Brown Douglas arms the truth of a Black mother's faith in these times of Stand Your Ground. And of course, you know, we will talk more about what Stand Your Ground is, but I thought that that blurb was very powerful. And I hope that, you know, as you're sitting with that for a minute, you find it powerful as well. And from there, I'm going to read a little bit about Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas. And basically what the blurb says is that she is the inaugural Dean of Episcopal Divinity School at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. She has served as canon theologian at the Washington National Cathedral and the director of the religion program at Grutcher College in Baltimore, Maryland, where she holds the Susan D. Morgan Professorship of Religion. Prior to coming to Grutcher College, she was Associate Professor of Theology at Howard University School of Divinity in Washington, D.C., and served as Assistant Professor of Religion at Edward Waters College in Jacksonville, Florida. A native of Dayton, Ohio, Dr. Douglas was ordained in 1985 at St. Margaret's Episcopal Church, the first Black woman to be ordained an Episcopal priest on the Southern Ohio Diocese, and one of the only five nationwide at the time. In 2012, she was the first to receive Anna Julia Cooper Award by the Union of Black Episcopalians for her literacy, boldness, and leadership in the development of a womanist theology and discussing the complexities of Christian faith in African American contexts. Essence magazine counts her among this country's most distinguished religious thinkers, teachers, ministers, and counselors. She is widely published in national and international journals. Her other books include The Black Christ, What Faith Got to Do with It, both from Orbis Books, as well as Black Body / Christian Souls and Black Bodies and the Black Church, A Blue Slant. She is also co-editor of Sexuality and the Sacred Sources for Theological Reflection. So, as you see here, Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas has a really big background in talking about theology and the church. And I think it's also cool that she's also ordained in the church, because I think it's one thing to be a theologian that just talks about the church, but also being a theologian that talks about the church that is actually really entrenched and part of the ministry of the church. I feel like this woman really has an extensive background and knows what she's like talking about / getting herself into, because of her not only, you know, talking about theology, but also being a part of it in such a big way. I guess I think about this like with me, if I decided I wanted to be a pastor, now it will go beyond me like just talking about theology because it's kind of something I'm interested in, but actually really understanding the intricacies of it, because I'm having to learn what it really takes to shepherd a church, put a church together, and all that stuff. So I guess that's kind of the point I'm trying to make with her not only being a theologian or a person that is a professor in theology, but also someone that's a reverend. And, you know, so it's all really cool to kind of read that about her. And I actually did not know that she was one of the only five that were ordained nationwide when she became ordained. So that's pretty dope as well. And so briefly, I'll talk about what made me pick this book. So originally, I was given this book as an option to read for class. It was basically a class that I took at Loyola at grad school with my master's in social justice. And we were asked to take a class on the foundations of social justice, just so that we can understand a little bit more about what it means when we say social justice, right? And so with this class, I had a really cool professor named David Dolt, and he introduced us to this book. I had never, ever, ever read anything by Kelly Brown Douglas before. I don't even know if I actually had heard of her before, but this class really opened me up to her writing and a little bit more to like this womanist idea too, because I was still pretty new to womanist theology. So it was really cool. And so with reading this book and with being in this class and the other things that we're reading, basically the goal of this class was to kind of give us a framework for understanding what the work of social justice looked like. It also helped us kind of identify and clarify some of the problems when it comes to the terminology of justice, because I think one of the things that we quickly learned as we were partaking in this class is that, you know, justice is such a, I guess, like a big general term, and it kind of varies of what justice looks like for each region. So, for example, since I'm in Florida, what might look like justice for the state of Florida might look like totally different for another state, like in Chicago, where I was at for school. Some things may be pretty similar. A lot of it is still pretty much determined or like looked at by like the lens of we have to, you know, abolish white supremacy, blah, 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 blah. But what abolish white supremacy or what justice looks like for each state will always be a little different, because everybody in the states have different needs. So each state has its own needs, right? So I loved this class because it really forced us to kind of stretch our mind and think through what does it mean to really seek out justice, and not just seek out justice, but also look at it from like a biblical worldview. Since, you know, the school was Catholic and they are Jesuit, like Catholic background, it was really a time to like really sit together and reflect on, okay, what does justice mean? And very quickly we were like, oh shit, like this is deeper than what we are envisioning or what we thought this meant, right? But nonetheless, I really like this class and I love that we were introduced to this book. And I really, really, really learned a lot from it, especially being that I was not somebody that was born in this country. And I feel like Dr. Douglas really touches on a lot of topics and things that I never had to think about because I wasn't, you know, born in this country. And especially I would say I was an African American that had to endure a lot of the things in this country. Because, I mean, there are people that are born in this country, and especially if they're not African American, are very removed from the realities, right? So obviously this book became like a very integral part of my learning about what was going on in this country or what was in the backdrop of this country from the past until now, right? And so when we talk about the general topic or issue that, you know, she's going to cover in the book, Douglas basically says that this book explores the social cultural narratives that have given birth to stand your ground culture and the religious canopies that have legitimized it. This stand your ground culture has produced and sustained slavery, black codes, Jim Crow, lynching, and other forms of racialized violence against black bodies. And so from there, she kind of goes on to explain that part one of the book, which is chapters 1 through 3, will kind of examine the stand your ground culture that took Trayvon's life. So from this part, she takes time to kind of just explore the origins of stand your ground culture and kind of gives us some of the narratives from like a social, cultural, and a religious point of view that kind of fostered it and kept it going. And then part two of this book, which is chapters 4 through 6, she addresses the meaning of God for these stand your ground times. And through this, she kind of explores the strength of the Black faith tradition and kind of suggests where God is and what he is saying in this time of like your stand your ground war. And this is kind of implying that not only is stand your ground culture a thing of the past, but it's something that's in the present and it's kind of going to continue on into the future until we do something about it, right? So I love the way that she kind of goes through this, because I would say that she does a really good job of using like storytelling, history, direct quotes from, you know, the people that were involved in scripture to just kind of paint a picture of what's going on. And I feel like, you know, just thinking through a lot of this, there's probably so much more stuff that she could have pulled from. But again, I think she does a good job of picking the things that are needed to make the point that she's trying to make. And so from chapter one, she kind of takes a deep dive into the topic of American exceptionalism by talking about, you know, the Anglo-Saxon myth, and just kind of how this myth kind of provided a foundation for stand your ground culture. And so in this chapter, you just kind of see that God's presumed preferential option for Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism kind of leads to this really big focus on of whiteness and like the preferential option for whiteness and the degradation of blackness. And then from here, chapter two, she starts to explore some of the construction of the black body as, you know, perpetually guilty chattel, which was a very interesting chapter for me to read, especially when she dives deeper into like how the black body became hypersexualized, how, you know, white people kind of use this idea of them being chattel as a way to just create all of these horrible racial stereotypes and justify using the black body however they saw fit. A very hard chapter to read, if I'm honest. And then in chapter three, she goes on to kind of examine the relationships between the narrative of manifest destiny and stand your ground culture. And so in this chapter, she argues that America's sense of manifest destiny kind of resulted in the declaration of like just war on black bodies. And you kind of see that evident in events and policies that came about, like black codes, Jim Crow, lynching, the war on drugs, and different things like that. And it's interesting for me to see her talk about this idea of just war, because I know when I was at Loyola, when we talked about just war, it was around this idea of like, how can we find ways to prevent war and kind of promote peace? So in a lot of the writings that I read from the different religious leaders from the Catholic faith, you saw that when they talked about just war and just war theory, it was more about like, no matter what, we really need to do what we can to prevent war from happening and to promote peace. So whatever we can do, let's not get into war, right? But here in this chapter, she kind of, you know, talks about how war is justified against black bodies because their freedom essentially means that it kind of diminishes the plans that white people had for this country and manifest destiny and all that stuff. And I should say Anglo-Saxons, because whiteness came a little later, which I'll talk about a little later in the book. And then from chapter 4, 5, and 6, it was really cool because she takes some time to really talk about the black faith tradition. And so in chapter 4, she kind of begins by, you know, providing a fundamental understanding of God within the black faith tradition by kind of revisiting black faith understandings of the Exodus tradition, which is in the Bible, the Exodus story. And so she kind of uses these narratives to talk about the paradox between maintaining black faith, but then also having to stand in the midst of stand your ground culture. And then from there in chapter 5, she explores the theological and faith dynamics between Jesus and Trayvon. And this was really interesting to me because she looks at the cross and the resurrection and how there's a lot of parallels to the lynchings and a lot of things that happen towards black bodies in this country, and how that specifically ties to the idea of the justice of God. And for me, I know this chapter was pretty eye-opening because I never saw the cross in the Roman times as the way of which the Romans kind of used to maintain their power. And so to have that parallel to how lynchings and Jim Crow and all that stuff was a way that America used to maintain its power in a similar way was mind-blowing to me. And then in the future, when I read The Cross and the Lynching Tree, which I will talk about on this podcast a little bit too, it just all kind of really came together, you know, for me. So I really enjoyed this chapter because of the way that she was able to tie those two things. And then lastly, she talks a little bit about Black prophetic testimony and the time of God. And so with the Martin Luther King speech, I Have a Dream, as a backdrop, she uses chapter 6 to revisit America's narrative of exceptionalism and the Black faith tradition to kind of discern the message of God to us in this like stand your ground culture. And so at the end of this book, Brown kind of notes that she's not attempting to resolve the issues of stand your ground culture, but instead she's inviting her readers to engage in the hard soul searching need for our country to become a safer place for Black children to live and just be free. And so again, I love that she uses all these different stories and history and quotes and scriptures to kind of pull that all together and hopefully challenge her readers to think differently on the topic. And I will say that's something that kind of came up for me. And so there's a lot to kind of get from this book. So I'm not going to focus so much on all these individual chapters. I just gave you guys like a synopsis of each one. But I did want to talk a little bit about some of the topics she brought up in this book, because I know for me, at the time of reading these books, I never thought about them at all. And I know as I was learning more and more about these different topics, later on, I ended up using, you know, what I learned from this book to kind of create my capstone or my thesis for my master's, because I was so like intrigued by what she presented. And I was slowly starting to see all of the things that she brought up within my life that I was like, okay, there's some truth to this. And I wanted people to know about it. I wanted people to be challenged by it. So I ended up using it as part of what drives like my research interests in my paper, you know. So some of the topics that did stick out to me included like the topic of American exceptionalism, which I don't think we talk about enough. Manifest Destiny, which I grew up learning about as a kid in my little private school. And then just again, this topic of stand your ground culture, because I think in a way, like I've heard about it in a lot of ways, but to really have it, you know, defined and explained was very important for me as I was learning. And so, you know, briefly with this topic of American exceptionalism, I was very intrigued by her bringing up this Romanian historian named Tacitus, because, you know, basically in 98 CE, this person published this thing called Germania, which was, I think, a book or something. And she quotes, she says that it basically became the most dangerous book that was ever written. And the reason she said that was not necessarily because of what he said, but more so how people have interpreted it over time. Which I would argue is very similar to how Americans and Christians in general have interpreted scripture. Like, we basically have very great things given to us in the Bible about morality and how to care for other people. But instead of, you know, using it in a way that helps other people, we've kind of used it and interpreted it in a way that promotes oppressive structures like white supremacy. And she later goes on to note that a lot of the things that this man Tacitus put in this book ended up playing a huge role in like the Nazis creating their program towards like racial purity. And then also it played a role in creating this whole stand your ground culture and even like American exceptionalism, which is nuts. And I know for me, I already was kind of like, oh, this is crazy that Americans and Nazi Germans had something in common. But like also now as I'm older and wiser, I mean, we're seeing how there's still friggin' neo-Nazis running around in this country, even though we saw what happened in the past and it wasn't good, right? So there's that. So in the first few pages of the book, Douglas kind of goes on to just describe a little bit of what Tacitus kind of writes in his book Germania. And so I was just going to read a little bit of it so you can hear what his mindset was and kind of how that later plays a role in Americanism and all this bullshit, right? And so she says in like pages 3 and 4, in Germania, Tacitus provides a meticulous portrait based on others' writings and observations of the Germanic tribes who fended off Rome's first century empire building agenda. He identifies the tribes as an aboriginal people, free from all taint of intermarriages. They are, he says, a distinct unmixed race, like none but themselves, with fierce blue eyes, red hair, huge frames. Tacitus commended these Germans for their bravery and strong moral character. No one in Germany, he explains, laughs at vice. He went on to say that for these Germans, good moral habits were more effectual than good laws. Perhaps what is most significant, at least in garnering the attention of political architects for centuries to come, is that Tacitus portrayed these ancient Germans as possessing a particular respect for individual rights and almost instinctive love for freedom. This was evident, he said, by the way in which they govern themselves. According to Tacitus, within the various tribes, the whole tribe deliberated upon all important matters, and most final decisions rest with the people. Tacitus seemed to be describing a community that encouraged the participation of its members, at least the male members, in governance and criminal procedures. According to many later interpreters, Tacitus was describing the perfect form of government. This was one that respected common law, trial by jury, and individual liberties. Tacitus' description of these tribal governmental systems influenced the nature of various Western systems of government throughout history. As we will see, it played no small role in America's form of democracy. But this was not the only way in which the Germania influenced the shape of various Western societies, with playing a role in determining systems of governance. It laid the foundation for the subjugation, if not elimination, of certain peoples, those who were not members of the unmixed race that Tacitus described. So there's a lot here, but one of the things that I thought was really interesting is like, there's so much of this little blurb that I was like, oh my gosh, like this is such a big part of our society. And there's a lot of things in here, like especially my idealistic self that I didn't necessarily see a problem with, like especially when we talk about trial by jury, people having their individual rights and, you know, the sense of like, we need to have moral habits and good character. Some of that stuff isn't bad, but I did think it was really interesting how this interpretation of Tacitus, which she talks about in the book, really came down to what type of blood you come from, your bloodline, right? So for the Puritans and the Pilgrims, she describes later on, like she was saying that they thought they had a direct bloodline to these German people. And so as Anglo-Saxon people, they saw the Anglo-Saxons as a direct descendant and direct bloodline to these groups of people. So if you did not have that direct bloodline, automatically it deemed you unworthy or inferior. And so obviously that started being shown to how like the Puritans and these Pilgrims started treating Native Americans, how they treated African Americans that they brought here, how they treated even other immigrants. So I know she talks about it like old stock and new stock, which is weird to describe it that way. But if you weren't directly having like this English pure blood of Anglo-Saxon pure blood, they treated people differently. So I know a lot of the times we hear this argument from other white people like, oh, Italians weren't treated well either, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's because if you Italians and some of these, you know, groups of people, even though they were also white, they didn't have this pure blood or this Germanic or whatever the hell blood like that it was described by this author. And so because they didn't have this pure Anglo-Saxon blood, they were treated like shit for a while. And again, this writing played such a huge role in that. And to me, it was crazy that we weren't taught this shit in school, right? We were just taught the fluffy, like, you know, version of this in some ways, right? And especially given the fact that this writing by Tacitus eventually played a role into this idea of like America being exceptional because of their race and because of their Anglo-Saxon bloodline, right? And then that later played into this idea of manifest destiny, which I thought was really interesting. I think it's something that we really, really need to be talking about more, even if it, you know, makes us extremely uncomfortable, right? And then, so I do want to talk a little bit about how language and religion and policy eventually played a role in us switching from this whole, like, only Anglo-Saxon identity to whiteness. But I did want to talk a little bit about manifest destiny, because again, I think this is such an important thing when we're talking about why Standurion culture is the way it is. Like, it's good that we talk about it, because in manifest destiny and American exceptionalism kind of ends up being tied together from my understanding of this text. And that, you know, part of these people seeing themselves as like this important race of people, it kind of led to them also seeing themselves as like this beacon to the rest of the world, right? And so she does talk about a series of different preachers and political figures and all that stuff that really highlight that America is going to be the city on a hill that kind of leads the way into bringing like glory to God, you know. And so in particular, she talks about Lyman Beecher as one of them. And so he basically said in a few of his sermons that America is going to become the moral power that is going to evangelize to the rest of the world. Right. And I know in some of my other research that I've done on this topic, because I thought this idea of city on the hill is just such a fascinating concept. There was another person named John Withrop in 1630, while he was aboard the Arabella before the ship departed to the New World, inspired by verses in Matthew 5. Where it talks about, you know, Christians being like the light of the world and the city on a hill that cannot be hidden and basically an example to other people, right? He uses those verses to create like this vision for what the new Puritan colony was going to become. And so he basically says that, "For we must consider that we shall be a city upon a hill, the eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world, we shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God, and all professors for God's sake. We shall shame the faces of many of God's worthy servants and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us till we be consumed out of the good land whither we are going." So in layman's term, it's really interesting because, you know, these people are seeing like this new world as like this model of Christian charity. And so what they're saying is the United States was supposed to be an example to the rest of the world of what it means to be a truly godly society, or else people will essentially turn away from God, you know. And it's so interesting to hear all this from people like Withrop and people like Beecher and the other many people that Douglas quotes in the book, and then to see all the things that they did in the name of creating the city of the hill was fucking nuts, you know? And so as Douglas is talking about the creation of American exceptionalism through the Anglo-Saxon myth, and then also talking about manifest destiny, you kind of see this idea of stand your ground culture emerge. And then stand your ground culture basically becomes this culture about protecting whiteness, which is what becomes the most like cherished property in this country during that time and moving forward, right? And so anything that's not white, anything that doesn't tie to American exceptionalism, anything that goes against this idea or this perceived idea of manifest destiny has to be stopped, you know? And it was really interesting for me as an immigrant to just watch how you're watching all this white rage and panic be described throughout the book, because there was periods in this book or in this time frame or these time frames where the Anglo-Saxon people started dwindling because all these other immigrants came in. And so essentially they had to reframe, what does it look like to be Anglo-Saxon or to be American? And so that eventually looked like people that have white skin could fit this category. People that knew how to speak English in the way that they thought was proper became part of that category. People who are Protestant became part of that category. So little by little, it went from this Anglo-Saxon pure blood thing to, are you white? Can you speak English the way we think English should be spoken? Do you follow the Protestant religion? So little by little, you see all of these different things kind of emerge and change because they were trying to essentially protect this identity of Americanism and exceptionalism and, you know, this myth of manifest destiny. Like, so again, it was really weird for me reading about all of these men that I grew up learning about in school and being told that they were such moral characters and great men and great presidents and all that stuff, and just reading the garbage that they say throughout this book is just, it's crazy. And I do love that, you know, Kelly Brown Douglas takes a lot of time to really just give you so many direct quotes about what, you know, these different writers, scientists, religious leaders, all that stuff say about Black bodies and Black people. But I will say, as I was reading this, I was particularly drawn to the manifest destiny crap and how it was connected to like land and race and like who has the right to land and who doesn't, and how it particularly ended up affecting Native Americans. And so she did put a quote in here where John Quincy Adams was quoting another person named Henry Clay, who's like the Secretary of State at the time, I guess. And so he says that Henry Clay believes it is impossible to civilize Indians, that there never was a full-blooded Indian who took to civilization. It's not in their nature. He further said, Clay believed they were destined to extinction, and although he would never use or countenance inhumanity towards them, he did not think them as a race worth preserving. And then Brown later goes on to say, history shows us that the Anglo-Saxon mission of manifest destiny considered Native Americans unworthy candidates for assimilation. They therefore became targets of extinction. And then she says, there is no better example of this than the Indian Removal Act, which President Andrew Jackson signed into law May 28, 1830. While this law was presumably a benevolent policy to remove Indians beyond the white settlements, it resulted in the forced removal of many Native Americans. Reportedly, 4,000 Cherokees died on a forced march later known as the Trail of Tears. And then she ends this little section by saying that the Anglo-Saxon manifest destiny mission of land, race, and life intruded on Native American bodies first. And I know that this book kind of focuses a little bit on, like, you know, African American or Black people and how Stand Your Ground culture has affected us, present day, past, and how it can potentially be challenged in the future and things like that. But I did like that she took a minute to acknowledge that Stand Your Ground and Manifest Destiny, all that stuff also affected the Native American community, particularly when we look at how these Anglo-Saxons justified, like, kicking them out of their own land because of this call from God, quote unquote. And I think the wild part about the story between Native Americans and Anglo-Saxons or the Pilgrims or whatever is that a lot of the times when you hear stories about how Native Americans treated the early settlers, it's always that they helped them and they were kind to them and they gave them food and blah, blah, blah. And then for them to turn around and just say, well, if these people don't want to assimilate to what we have to offer, then they deserve extinction. That's so wild to me to think about. Again, especially considering that these Native Americans provided so much for these settlers to survive and then welcome them in a space that wasn't even theirs to begin with. And I know, like, given what I've said, that I grew up in the Christian church, I never thought to think through this and challenge this. And especially now that I'm deconstructing and learning, you know, especially through this book, how Manifest Destiny and Stand Your Ground culture and all this stuff just kind of plays a role in justifying this and how they use scripture and language and all this stuff to make it seem normal. It's crazy to, like, now be on the outside of this and be like, holy shit, like, you essentially use scripture and all this other stuff to justify your greed, and you essentially told us that this was God's will and all this other stuff. But at the end of the day, I would almost venture to say that, you know, these people were following their will and then using God to kind of justify it, right? And so I feel like this book kind of puts you in quite a predicament to kind of sit down and think about all of this and kind of wrestle with all of this, right? Especially if you are a person that grew up in the church and this stuff was, like, gospel to you, you know? So, and I know for me, it was a little easier for me to snap out of this haze that the evangelical bubble puts me in or puts us in because of the fact that I am Black and a lot of this shit affects me. But I think if you especially grew up white and you grew up learning about this Anglo-Saxon race and how you descended from it and how it was God's will and you're superior, it's kind of hard to have to challenge that now, I would imagine. But for me, I'm just like, nah, y'all shitty. Like, it didn't take me that long to challenge that. Especially, again, I will argue that, you know, when you really look at the tenets of what Germania presented and these ideas around, you know, being a city on a hill and trying to create an example of morality, those things in itself aren't bad. And I do think those are things we want to strive for. I know with me and myself too, like, I'm saying to you guys on this podcast every week that I want to be an example of what deconstructing looks like or how to love other people that are different. I'm saying that I want to do those things, right? But if I'm saying that I want to do that stuff, but then I'm also at the same time oppressing other people, you know, shutting their voices and taking shit from them and killing them, or if I'm doing all this other stuff that's to the contrary of that, at some point, all of you guys are going to turn off the podcast and be like, this bitch is a liar. You know what I mean? And so I think that's what this book is kind of showing us. When you're looking at these different pages, you're reading these quotes, you're looking at history. And again, this is all shit that you can, you know, look up and verify. Like, history is not stuff that you're not able to verify, right? So if you look up a lot of this stuff and you see what was really said, and I mean, especially because at some point white people were super proud of themselves for this shit, right? you really notice, like, damn, like, there was truly, truly a disconnect here. And so I even think about myself when I got to go to the African American Museum in DC, and just being able to go through the different floors and, like, reading what men like Abraham Lincoln, for example, said about slaves, like, direct quotes from some of his speeches and shit. I was like, why do we spend so much time in school praising him for the Emancipation Proclamation and all this shit when he really didn't care about Black people? Like, he really didn't care. He mostly was concerned about keeping the United States together. Like, he didn't give a shit about the fact that Black people were slaves. Or even if you think about everything that happened with Jefferson and how he's this moral leader or whatever he wants to be, but then he's, like, raping slaves, you know. And he, I know, like, as a kid, they made this story between Jefferson and Sally Hemsworth, or I don't remember her last name, but the slave girl, like, they made her story so, like, romantic, and, oh my God, they fell in love and they chose each other. And I was just sitting here, like, as an adult, I'm like, he was raping her. Like, he he was a disgusting piece of shit like the rest of these slave owners that were raping their people. And so, again, I think as a country, we need to stop and stop romanticizing these people and what they said, and or what we think they said, or romanticizing America as in general, and actually look at it and say, enough is enough. Like, we need to change. We need to challenge ourselves. We need to be better. And so I did love, even though as hard as it was to read these quotes and to really read some of this history, Kelly really encourages us to do that. And so, yeah, so just to, you know, wrap this part up, I guess, when we look at American exceptionalism, Manifest Destiny, and Stand Your Ground culture, essentially, it really comes down to America is an exceptional place because of the Anglo-Saxons who really came here and put this shit together, and its language and the policies and its religion and the fact that it's so good at being this moral high ground for everybody else. Manifest Destiny kind of justified all of this by saying that because we're chosen by God, we're able to create this just war, like, to against all these different non-white or non-Anglo-Saxon bodies to get what we want. And then Stand Your Ground is basically about protecting those things, especially whiteness. And again, you know, Stand Your Ground culture first really was trying to protect the Anglo-Saxons due to, like, their blood. But over time, you know, a lot of different groups of people were able to assimilate and become a part of this idea of, like, whiteness or Americanism because of, you know, their skin tone, their ability to learn the language, their ability to become Protestant, all this different stuff. And so I do think that stuff is really interesting too as a Black person, because, like, due to my education, due to me being Protestant and some other stuff, there's ways that I'm kind of able to assimilate into whiteness and white society and be in predominantly white spaces and pass and whatever. But at the end of the day, as soon as my Blackness becomes a hindrance to the work of white supremacy, that's where I find that I'm met with the door, because they don't want me to, again, break into this status quo and challenge their bullshit. And they want me to kind of back off at that point, right? And I think a lot of people of color can relate to that, where at some point, they're being a person of color has to be brought into the forefront, because there's only so far that they can assimilate until whiteness is like, whoa, 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 you're not allowed in this space anymore. And so that's really interesting. And lastly, I think one of the cool things about this book is that, you know, Kelly Brown Douglas ends by talking about Black faith. And so she kind of starts by talking about Stand Your Ground culture war and how it's a story of two faiths, right? And so she says, there is a faith of a father whose son was not collateral damage of war, but actually the target. There is also the faith of a nation whose very identity created the war that targeted Trayvon. Standard Ground Culture War reveals two different faith claims, presumably about the same God. Each claim, in effect, reflects a different side of the same story, the story of the Israelites' exodus. The father's faith claim points to the story of the God who liberates the Israelites from a land where their bodies were being devalued and destroyed. The faith of the nation tells the story of the same God who called the Israelites to a land where unsuspecting bodies were crushed and conquered. The faith of the father points to an Exodus God who is with a people through a wilderness journey to forge a new life. The faith of the nation signals an Exodus God who is with the people through a wilderness journey to bring unexpected death to many others. The faith of a nation gives way to a culture that negates Black life. The faith of a father affirms Black life in the midst of a culture of death. And I love that she kind of talks about the Exodus story in this way, because basically she's saying, on one hand, America or this nation, the way that they look at this Exodus story is that they were meant to go to some promised land and become this city on a hill, this nation that is a beacon to God. And so their whole purpose was to go to this promised land and do whatever they can to create it, right? But then on the other hand, we have this other side of the story where, you know, it represents, you know, Black people, and that we were being destroyed and devalued and all this stuff. And, you know, Egypt, our version of Egypt, right? And, you know, God sees this and he helps us out of it and provides us an opportunity to experience freedom, right? And when I read this part of this chapter or this book, and I know she even brought it up before, I felt like this uncomfortable feeling, because I had to sit with this at first, with this idea of God, you know, bringing people out of Egypt and allowing them to destroy a whole group of people to build a city, you know, and similar into like what these Americans did when they came here, or the colonizers did when they came here, right? And for me, I feel like it's hard to sit with that idea. And I had to figure out, like, okay, how much of this was really these men who decided this is what we're going to do, and we're going to write in this book, like, God asked us to do this, or how much was that really God was inspiring him to do it? You know what I mean? And I know for me, as a person that sees God as love and mercy and all that stuff, it's hard to sit with this idea of a God who'd okay a group of people like wiping another group of people off the face of the earth. You know, that was really hard for me to sit with. And I can't say that I have a good answer or a good thought to how to swallow that, because I have none. You know, it's still a hard thing to wrestle with. But I do like that she then, with this story, she's asked you to really think about this idea of Kairos time. And so I bet you, and like I was wondering, what the hell is a Kairos time, right? And she goes to define it in page 203. She says, Kairos time is the right or opportune time. It is a decisive moment in history that potentially has far-reaching impact. It is often a chaotic period, a time of crisis. However, it is through the chaos and the crisis that God is fully present, disrupting things as they are and providing an opening to a new future. To God's future, Kairos time is therefore a time pregnant with infinite possibilities for new life. Kairos time is God's time. It is a time bursting forth with God's call to a new way of living in the world. It is God's calling to us to a new relationship with our very history and sense of self, and thus a new relationship with one another and even with God. And so I read this because I love the way she defined it. But the cool thing about this concept of Kairos time is that she uses this terminology to describe a little bit of what happens after the Israelites end up leaving Egypt and going into the promised land, right? And you see that after God kind of, you know, supposedly opens this place for them, allows them a space for they can be free and experience, you know, the land of milk and honey and all that stuff, the Israelites start oppressing people as well. They start making decisions where they're hurting the people that are in the space that they're in, similar to what we see with Americans or the Puritans and the Pilgrims, where they use their freedom to oppress other people, to hurt other people. And so Douglas kind of notes, like, there's a point in scripture where God sends prophets to kind of hold Israel accountable for what they're doing in their history. And so she says that you see that even though they come from a place of bondage to freedom, they're over here oppressing other people. And these prophets were basically there to remind these Israelites how far they had come and to remind them of their responsibility as a nation to kind of live into the freedom which they were given, right? And that kind of means, you know, that they had a responsibility to not only the people that they were inhabiting, but to God and to each other, and to kind of live a life of morality and not oppressing other groups of people, right? And so Douglas looks at these things to kind of then show us how, you know, it's the same as kind of happening in our current time, especially with Black spirituality and Black faith. We have kind of become the prophetic voices now that are taking on the places of these prophets to kind of remind America, like, hey, you were given this freedom and these opportunities and all this other stuff, and instead of you using it as a space to oppress other groups of people, this is a Kairos time where you can turn back and acknowledge what's going on and change for the better and create another way, you know? And so for me, I find this idea very powerful, even though I know lately I struggle with this whole concept of, like, I don't know, a lot of the time most people of color are very open to being like, okay, white people, let's come together, let's work, let's do the right thing, blah, blah, blah. It's that part is exhausting, but I also found it empowering that she was saying, like, just like, you know, there were prophets back in the day that were calling out the Israelites for their foolishness, like, Black people are kind of doing that now too, you know, and speaking truth to power. And I don't know, that was just powerful to me. And this is where you kind of see her use the work of MLK to kind of show us that. And so she talks about this idea of prophetic Black testimony. And she says, usually this prophetic Black testimony calls the nation to moral memory, moral identity, moral participation, and moral imagination. And she goes on to define all of these, which I will in a second. But I love the power of that. I love especially the one that really stood out to me. Well, there's a few that stood out to me, but I love this, the first, the idea of moral memory, because basically she was saying that moral memory is nothing less than telling the truth about the past and one's relationship to it. Moral memory is not about exonerating ourselves from the past, rather it is taking responsibility for it. To have a moral memory is to recognize the past we carry within us, the past we want to carry within us, and the past we need to make right. Writing the past is about more than facile apologies or even guilty verdicts for killers of innocent Black children. Rather, to write the past is to acknowledge the ways in which our system structures and the way of being in society are a continuation of the myths, the narratives, and the ideologies of the past, and then to transform these present realities. Whew. And so the moral memory one is one of my favorites, because I think this is what it really comes down to for me with deconstruction, and how it's so important to just take an honest look and just say, hey, I fucked up. Like, this ideal even that Americans tried to come up with of, like, being the city of the hill, we're so far removed from that. And we need to do better and own it and like move forward, right? And so I, you know, as much as like I wish that we could do that, it's very obvious that we're so far from wanting to do that. But I love that Douglas kind of brings up the idea that through Black people like King and other people like Baldwin and all these Black prophetic voices, that they were able to like call the nation to this sense of moral memory and just remind them that it's time to, you know, just expose the travesties that kind of come with America's exceptional identity and call it what it is and challenge it. And I think, like, you know, from reading this, it was a reminder to me that if it wasn't for a lot of these different Black voices, and even in this current day, a lot of Black voices are just more willing to call a duck and be like, dude, like, the city of the hill bullshit and all this other stuff that you guys are claiming to be, we were never that. Let's come together and actually fix it and, you know, be better and stand up for freedom together. And of course, like, we get ignored and all that stuff, but I am constantly just inspired by the willingness of all these different Black people to just continue to speak up and speak out and say shit. Even to the point where I know for me, now that I've been on TikTok, just watching all of these different Black creators take the time to explain all of this different history that white people are just trying so hard to bury is astonishing. I know there's days where like I learn something and I'm like, what? And then I have to go look it up. Like, you know, things like, you know, people feeding Black people to gators at one point, or Black people being delicacies and people eating us, or, you know, people using our bones and our skin and all this stuff for shit. And it's just, again, to me, I'm reading this and I'm like, why isn't this common knowledge? But again, because Americans are just working so hard to bury the truth and not deal with it, it's very difficult for us to move past, you know, our history or move through it because we're not acknowledging it. And how many times have we heard the same bullshit line, like, this is not the America we know and love, this isn't us. And I know for me, I'm sitting here like, yes, it is. I'm tired of this, you know? And so I'm, again, as I was reading this chapter, I was just reminded of all the different Black people out here that are doing the best that they can to call America to this sense of, we got to own this. We got to do better. And it's, and even then, it's not even we all the time, but you know what I mean? Like, we got to do better, right? And make things right. And with that too, I did like the whole idea of moral participation, and essentially it became like this idea of working together towards the commitment to freedom, love, and life, which again, it's part of the ideals of the American dream, but I know essentially, it was kind of created to be only applied to white people or the Anglo-Saxon. So that's a bummer. But I like that Black testimony is a reminder to that, obviously. And then lastly, I really like the one on moral imagination, because Douglas kind of says, a moral imagination is grounded in the absolute belief that the world can be better. Moral imagination envisions Isaiah's new heaven and new earth, where the wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and trusts that it will be made real. What is certain, a moral imagination disrupts the notion that the world as it is reflects God's intention. With a moral imagination, one is able to live proleptically, that is, as if the new heaven and earth are already here. This means one's life is not constrained by what is. It is oriented toward what will be. Moral imagination allows Black bodies to live as free Black bodies despite the forces that would deny that fact. A moral imagination defies the power of stand-around culture. It recognizes this culture as a human construct that does not reflect God's eternal law. And so, me as a person that really has loved learning about liberation theology over the years, and especially the idea of the reign of God and all that stuff. I love this definition of moral imagination because, I don't know, I think one of the things that oftentimes that happens within the Christian culture especially is that the oppressed groups are always encouraged to like kind of think of, oh, you know, one day in heaven, everything will be okay. One day in heaven, everything will be different. So count it all joy and power through it. Like, we're encouraged to and kind of enjoy the suffering in a way. When to me, I'm like, or, you know, we could work now towards that, you know, because I don't know, especially as I've gotten older and I'm just processing like death and thinking about, you know, how much closer I could be to it. I mean, I know I'm 30, but, you know, life happens, right? But, you know, I don't want for me or other people to just be living a life of like existence or just living a life of blah, just for the sake of maybe hopefully on the other side, things will be better, especially if we do have the power to do something, you know, about it now. And I know even for me, that's why I did get into social work. That's why I love the idea of social justice, because I like to think about, you know, the possibility of, you know, getting rid of some of these oppressive structures now so people can live, you know. And I will talk about this maybe more in the next podcast episode where I talk about social work and the industrial complex of that. But I know for me, I'm having to even wrestle with now, it's like, you know, we're all kind of slaves to capitalism. Like, I have to get up every day. I have these student loans that are like over my head that I can't break free. You know, especially as a millennial, I don't have the luxury of like wishing and hoping really that I can, you know, eventually buy a house and all this shit without a lot of work, because the market and the economy, it's like, it's ridiculous. You know I have a lot of friends that we're constantly like, man, is this really living? Because we're like having to power through jobs that are like stenched in white supremacy and are like horrible just because we have no other choice and we have shit to pay for. And it's like, is this living? You know, is this really living? And so I like this idea of like, what if we can work towards having people actually live free lives and enjoy their lives more? And it doesn't have to be just the one percenters that get to do that. Like, why can't we have a world where majority of the world can get to do that? And not just Americans, like, you know, people overseas as well who are getting like gutted by our country, which again, we don't talk about, but it's true, you know? So for me, I think I like this chapter on Black faith, or these chapters on Black faith, and how our faith can kind of inspire so much change. Because again, and it could be a bias, but I do think we end up thinking a lot about this stuff because due to assimilation and just due to colorism in general, I think a lot of different races end up shitting on us. So there's just things that, because of that, we end up being at the bottom, and we have to really think through a lot of this stuff and be truth tellers in a lot of spaces that we may not want to be truth tellers in. And I say this even saying, you know, at my work, there's a lot of the social workers there are Black women. And because of where we are in society, we're the ones always being like, yeah, but what about? And after a while, it gets exhausting to be the truth tellers of the room. But that's the reality, because there could be Latins in the room, or like white women or white men or all these other people there, and they may not say anything. Sometimes there will be, and it's great, but you know, a lot of times they don't say anything. So again, it's just something that I've observed, and I hate it from the bottom of my heart, but you know, it's something that we just have to contend with right now. But yeah, so to end, I will say this was a great book to read, especially as a person who was not born in this country. I learned so much about the history of this country, and I was also reminded of things that I learned as a little Protestant student in high school, middle school, when I was in Christian school. There was a lot of stuff that I was like, oh my God, this was romanticized, and this was actually a lot worse than I thought. So there was that. And I think it also forced me to think about immigration differently, because I think, you know, there was this thing of like, oh my gosh, like we have to work hard as Haitians to not be like African Americans. And there's like this intrinsic thing of like, I'm not black like these people. And I mean, the book talks about it with like the Italians and all the other people that were fighting for to be treated, you know, like the Anglo-Saxons by saying, I'm not black, I'm not black, right? And I was reading that, and I'm like, oh, that's fucked up. But then I would think about my family and how we would try to so hard to separate ourselves from being African-American, even though it's not like white people are looking at us and being like, oh, you Haitian? Okay, cool, cool, cool. You know, like you, they would treat you like shit because you're black. And that's it. That's the only qualifier, you know? So it forced me to even examine myself in that. That's something that my family did. And I did it kind of because it was something that was taught to me, right? But then as I got older and I realized how fucked up that is, now that's something that I'm like, oh, hey, family member, don't say that, because I'm starting to realize like even how much African Americans in this country had to go through just so my family can have the option to come to this country and study and have a house and, you know, be able to purchase anything or whatever, right? And even if we still have to deal with racism, right? There's a lot of generational bullshit that we got to bypass because of the fact that a lot of people came before us and fought for us to be able to do that. And even if African Americans didn't do any of that stuff for us, just the sheer fact that they're treated the way that they are treated is reason enough for us to want to challenge that and say, this is not okay behavior. So for me, one of the things that I was challenged to do as I read this book and read some others was to learn how to speak up against, you know, this idea of like us versus them when it came to African Americans and immigrant Black people, right? We need to challenge that. And I needed to challenge that. And so that's something I've been trying to do little by little, even in my own family. If somebody says I'm mad ignorant, I'm like, mm-mm. We're not doing that, you know, even if it's my own mother, I'm like, no, we're not doing that, you know? So, and then I try to explain why. Obviously, like, they're old Haitian people, so they may not always listen, but I do my best to keep bringing it up. And then lastly, I really liked, she ends, or and I think it was an end, but on page 160, she says this thing of the Black faith community must not be blind to the ways in which it is complicit or participates in denying certain bodies the freedom that God has given them. And for me, this was another area where I was like, ooh, this is such an important challenge, especially, I will say, when it comes to homophobia, because I oftentimes am saddened by the fact that, you know, Black people who are heterosexual, they are working so hard towards freedom from oppression from white people or, you know, other non-Black people. And they're so upset by that. But in the same breath, they're oppressing another group of people because they're different, or they may be seen as inferior for whatever reason, right? And even on top of that, I know there's intersectionality and there's Black people within our community that are also gay or, you know, LGBTQIA. But again, I think we miss the point sometimes on that. And so for me, that was a challenge of thinking about, what language am I using? What language am I encouraging that's going to oppress another group of people? Whether it is somebody that's in the LGBTQIA community, or maybe if it's somebody that's in the differently abled, like they have a disability or something, like what am I saying or doing that's promoting the mistreatment of them? You know, because again, I'm right now experiencing freedom in a lot of different areas because of my ability to go to school in certain spaces or be in certain spaces, whatever. So because I'm experiencing this freedom, I have to be mindful of not participating in shit that's going to be oppressing another group of people just because I can do it, you know? And I think this was a great reminder again of, again, that Exodus story of like, because the Israelites were freed from Egypt, they had a responsibility to not be complicit. And the same way as like these Puritans and whatever were free from the British rule, they should have had a responsibility to use that freedom for good rather than the bullshit they did, right? So in the same way as, you know, Black people and Black people of faith, whatever, like we need to be willing to not use our freedom in Christ and, you know, now that we're not so much under the slavery part and some of the other bullshit, to kind of, again, not be complicit. And I do think about it even with, like, again, with myself, now that I have a master's degree and I might be able to eventually be in spaces where I'm managing other people or, you know, in spaces where it's more predominantly white people and maybe I can have an opportunity, for example, to be on a board or whatever, right? I have to be mindful of not allowing myself to become an oppressor because I want to stay in those spaces. So even if that means that, you know, I might have to like step down or like I have to fight with people enough until they kick me out, so be it, you know, but I can't allow myself to, you know, be a shitty person just so I can stay in those spaces. And that's hard because when there's options for money or promotion or whatever it is, I think a lot of us people of color would rather stay in those positions than give up or like keep fighting and then eventually get kicked out or pushed out. I know that's very hard, you know, but again, it really comes back to what are we doing with our freedom? Like, what kind of person are we trying to be? And I know for me, I do want to actually be a good person and want to be an example to others in a way that's moral and not just for like the idealistic part of it, but like the reality part of it, you know? And again, I won't be perfect at it, but I don't want people to look at me and be like, oh my God, like Neff is never anywhere near this, like we're doing right now with Americans. Like we're looking at their ideals through this book and seeing what they wanted to be and having to, I don't know, feel bad or mourn or even just be disgusted by who they actually became, to, you know, and how they weren't even close to what the ideal was for them, right? And so, I don't know, that just gave me something to think about. And I hope what I said makes sense and it also gives you something to think about. But if not, again, feel free to add some comments on the post that I make about this or email me at connect@slowsessionswithneff.com. And, you know, I love to talk about it. But again, I think this book was really good at like just bringing up some ideas that a lot of us don't really challenge or think about or even have exposure to it. And so I know I'm very thankful to my professor that invited us to read this book and have us talk about it in class. And this is a book that has always really just stuck with me, even though I read this probably like 4 years ago, I think, or 3 years ago, and it just stuck with me. So I hope that this book could be something that sticks with you as well and challenges you. And so with that said, I thank you all again for joining me for another episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. And I look forward to hanging out with you guys again soon. Please enjoy my outro. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @SoulSessionsWithNeff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support. And until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.